Hi, I'm David Rothkopf, the CEO of the DSR Network and host of the Deep State Radio podcast. Here at DSR, we have always believed that in a world as complex, fast-moving, and full of risks as ours, we all need access to the best minds. That is why we have created the leading network for expert podcasts on the issues of the day you care about. We go in-depth on politics, the law, national security, foreign policy, intelligence, defense, climate, and new technologies with regular and special guests that are the leading voices in their fields. We also offer daily updates on global news, our DSR Daily, and on a key story of the day through our partnership with the New Republic. That is why over a million times a month, people like you choose to spend time with our hosts and guests. Membership is what supports this, and members get special benefits, including bonus content in virtually all of our podcasts. It's a big deal, and it's a good deal. Our monthly membership price is going to go up for the first time in our history on March 1st. So now is the time you can lock in our founder's rate of just $5 a month. To do so, go to the DSRnetwork.com and click on membership. It's that easy, but don't delay. Today's rates will only be available for a few more weeks. Join us. Support us. Go to the DSRnetwork.com right now. Thank you.
Nine. 12. 10. 28. 2 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf. We are gathered together to talk about some of the big issues going on in the world as we do every week and have every week for, I don't know, almost 10 years. I am joined today by part of the original gang, Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University Law Center. How are you doing, Rosa?
I'm great, David. I'm at the Georgetown University Law Center faculty retreat at the Salamander Resort in Middleburg. And I can just say, if anyone ever has an opportunity, if somebody else pay for them to be at the Salamander, I highly recommend it.
I've heard that before. We're joined by Ed Luce, who probably has been there because he goes to all the fashionable places. Hi, Ed.
Hi, David. Yes, I have been there. I would second Rose's recommendation.
The trick is to find someone else to pay for it, because otherwise it's a little out of my price range.
I was not funding myself either.
Well, you guys are moochers of the first order. We are also joined by Jeremy Conyndike, who is the president of Refugees International, and has been a guest here before and is a friend. Have you ever been to the Salamander Resort, Jeremy?
I have not found someone to spring for me to stay there yet, but it remains a goal.
Okay. Well, you and I will both
David
have to
is
work
gonna,
on that.
I think, going to have a Deep State Radio podcaster convention. He's going to send us all to the Salamander.
The extended cinematic universe of Deep State Radio can all join.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, we'll have the extended family out there just as soon as we break $1 billion in revenue here. I wanted to invite Jeremy back because he is so knowledgeable, both in his current capacity from his time at USAID, on humanitarian issues. And there's some humanitarian issues abroad and even some humanitarian issues here in the United States that we think deserve some attention. We've been hearing a lot of reports, Jeremy, that the situation in Gaza is going from bad to worse. Can you give us your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, what worries me, and I just joined with a few of my colleagues from other organizations over the weekend to publish a new op-ed in USA Today on this, is the risk of a looming famine. And I think it's worth breaking down a little bit how things get to that point. Normally, when you see a famine risk emerge, it's in a place like you know, Somalia, where you have very high baseline food insecurity, very stressed and chronically food insecure population, and then they'll get hit with a drought or a conflict, and that sort of can tip things towards the edge. You know, Gaza doesn't start from that point. So that really, to get to the edge of a famine now, as rapidly as they have, is highly, highly unusual. And Cindy McCain, the head of WFP, and obviously the wife of the late Senator John McCain, just tweeted today that that is the course that Gaza is on. That Gaza is on a trajectory towards famine unless there is a major change in the situation. And it's a really stunning descent for a population that was not pre-war terribly food insecure. So that I think is the main preoccupation of much of the humanitarian world right now, is how to avert that outcome.
How do you avert that outcome?
Well, three things to know about famine. One, it's very predictable. You know, we can see these things coming. There are tools to predict famine that rival something like the hurricane early warning scale in terms of their sophistication and their rigor. And those are built on a lot of failures in the past to see these things coming. But there is a five-phase scale for predicting them. So when you see those coming, they're preventable. We have the tools to prevent them. There are very sophisticated nutritional supplements and enriched food aid products and aid methodologies and you know, treatment protocols that can prevent a famine outcome, the level of death that you see with that, but only if those tools can be deployed. And this is the problem in Gaza right now, is the whole toolkit that we have that we want to roll out as humanitarians when we see a famine coming cannot roll out because of the way the conflict is being conducted.
Rosa, did you raise your hand in order to say something, or were you doing a kind of exercise that we're not aware of?
I was doing a little exercising and greeting the many minions who exist to serve me here at the Salamander, where no one is in danger of famine, which actually makes this a kind of a slightly morally revolting place to be sitting at the moment, where we are constantly being fed. And, you know, it's just obviously another reminder of the fact that the problem, we don't have famines because there's no food in the world. We have famines because of political choices that are made. And the, you know, famine in Gaza is of course, completely avoidable. If it happens, it will be because of, you know, criminal levels of negligence on the part both of Israeli officials, but also, frankly, on the part of the international community.
Well, I mean, that raises a question, which is, to what extent must the international community respond, particularly if the Israelis are dragging their feet? In other words, do we land ships on the coast of Gaza, force, you know, our way through? You know, what do you think, Ed? What you know, how this is a ghastly potential outcome. Does the U.S. have some kind of moral obligation here to stand up to our ally?
Yes. I mean, I would say at this point, that's an understatement. I mean, I think we saw it quite starkly illustrated with the UN vote this week on the ceasefire, and the United States was the sole country to vote against it, obviously vetoing it. Britain abstained, but the only vote against was the United States. It was in a minority of one. So when you ask what the international community could do, I have to say, I hear that question is, what should America be doing? And I think, you know, the frustrating thing about this situation is we know the answer to that question on a lot of fronts. I don't know. I mean, Jeremy's obviously got great expertise, so I don't know the particularities of how you deal with an incipient famine like this. But clearly, stopping the fighting, having a ceasefire, having a pause, leveraging America's considerable sway with the Israelis in order to enable all these conditions is absolutely key. I do have a question for Jeremy, though, and that is, you know, I am not an expert on this, but UNRWA, that the UN agency that's always been responsible, is obviously now a target of extreme controversy for many of its employees allegedly having helped Hamas. And it having turned a blind eye to Hamas networks and tunnels underneath some of its buildings in the Gaza Strip. What's the true picture, as far as you can tell, about this relief agency?
Well, I think you start with the fact that UNRWA has arguably, the hardest job in the UN system, or certainly one of them, in what they've had to do in Gaza and what they've had to navigate in Gaza. They have to substitute for, in effect, a municipal government for a population of 2 million people in an area that's controlled by a designated terrorist organization. That is a very, very hard situation to navigate. I think it is good that the UN is investigating the allegations that Israel made about these dozen or so staff. I think some of the other allegations feel a lot flimsier to me. The very broad allegations about 10% or 20% of their entire workforce has some tie. Israel should put something behind those, and put some more evidence behind those, or stop talking about it, frankly. For the dozen people that have been accused, there likely is evidence, although it sounds like that had not been provided even to the donors before all the donors led by the U.S. pulled the plug on funding temporarily. I think with something like the tunnels, look, there are tunnels all over Gaza. They go under all sorts of facilities. What can UNRWA be expected to know about them, and much less do about them? I don't know that there's a reasonable expectation that they would have a sense of where the tunnel network is. And I think the bigger question to me is why if Israel had these concerns about specific UNRWA staff members, what did they do about that before October 7th? UNRWA has told us and has told others that the warning that Israel shared about these 12 was the first time they'd gotten specific feedback and specific concerns on individual staff members in years. They have long shared all their staff lists with Israel. And so I think it does raise a question if you take at face value, which I don't necessarily, some of the allegations that Israel had made about huge numbers of UNRWA staff being compromised, that in turn raises the question of why didn't Israel provide actionable, usable information to UNRWA about that before?
Yeah, it's a reasonable question. I think I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but I think that UNRWA is 12,000 people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so 12 of 12,000 or 30 of 12,000, and that's the range Israel is just upped to 30 in terms of its allegations, as a justification for shutting down the primary deliverer of humanitarian aid to Gaza seems to me disproportionate.
Yeah.
Bartering on ludicrous and inhumane. Am I overstating it?
No, I think that's right. And if these were high level staff, leadership level staff, that would be one thing. If these were people that Israel had warned about and actions and warnings had not been acted upon, then that's relevant. We don't have any indication that that's true. So to all appearances, these were fairly low level staff who were not involved in the high leadership of UNRWA, and don't represent the totality of what the organization does. And in the meantime, more than 150 UNRWA staff have been killed in the course of the war since October 7th. So you've got more than 10 times as many staff killed in the war as are alleged to have been involved in the attacks.
I also think it's a subject that I know Jeremy has thought about a lot over the years, and this idea of the sort of shrinking of humanitarian space, right? I mean, it's sort of irrelevant, right? Maybe it's not 30, maybe it's 60, maybe it's 600 people in UNRWA who are actively sympathizing with Hamas and aiding and abetting Hamas. When it comes to, unless the allegation is that there is some really direct way in which the provision of food aid, et cetera, is actively leading to Israeli deaths or the deaths of others, the whole idea is you don't use people. There's so many innocent people. The vast majority of people in Gaza are innocent, that you don't punish them because they are in a situation in which some amongst them are militants and are doing things that we think are wrong, no matter how wrong they are. It's the same reason that we don't think starvation is an appropriate method of war. That these are and that humanitarian actors historically, you know, when Doctors Without Borders works, they don't say, well, we're only going to provide medical assistance to people of whom we morally approve. They say, we're going to patch you up. You know, if we find you, we're going to patch you up because that's what we do. You know, if we're going to do food aid, we're going to give you food aid, and we're going to leave the political decisions, the military decisions to others. And I think right now what we're seeing is, you know, yet another way in which that whole notion that there is or should be some humanitarian sphere that is distinct from the military and political spheres is just almost gone. Because you know it's the lives of you know thousands upon thousands of innocent people that will be destroyed if the response to suspicions about a small number of people within UNRWA lead to a collapse in the whole system of delivering assistance.
And there is a history of this kind of maximalist risk avoidance approach leading to or contributing to a famine. So if you look back at Somalia in 2011. It's kind of forgotten to history now, but in the 6 months leading up to the declaration of famine in Somalia, the U.S. had actually cut off food aid in Somalia because of concerns about the Al-Shabaab terrorist group and a risk of food. Some fraction of the food aid being diverted to Al-Shabaab led to the whole thing being shut down, which in turn contributed directly to the famine. So we know the danger of applying that kind of logic to a very desperate situation. And, you know, during my time in government, I came in, you know, following that. Part of my priority when I was dealing with places like Syria and Yemen, where you faced similar risks, was to avoid that kind of maximalist all or nothing thinking about risk and instead manage risk. Because as you say, Rosa, you know, yes, there's risk of diversion, but the risk on the opposite end of that is just a massive human toll. And I think that's the far greater risk we see in Gaza today.
And in terms of longer term, you know, rage, Palestinian anger at the Israelis, Palestinian anger at the international community, that the pretty good way to ensure, you know, permanent enmity is to engage in policies that lead to suffering and death for so many innocent people.
I mean, famines stick, right? My wife's Irish. Like, how much has Irish history been shaped and Ireland's kind of long-term relationship with England been shaped by the famine in the mid-1800s? You know, they still remember that. This is going to stick. This will be remembered.
Yeah. Ed's wife is Irish also, and she married him nonetheless.
It can be done.
And quite often cooks for me, irony of ironies.
Yeah, well, indeed. Ed, as you know, I wrote a column with Alon Pincus, which is in the New Republic right now, suggesting that the U.S. policy here is a big mistake, and we can't sort of take incremental steps away from it, and that certainly if this famine carries forward and actually starts to have the kind of toll that Jeremy suggests it might, it will compound the biggest error of this administration into something much, much worse. Which brings me to a question I like to ask every week, which is, how right was I in my column?
You were bang on. You were 100% right. I went through it with a sort of fine tooth pick and just, you know, couldn't find that error I was craving to find. I agree with you.
I apologize, Ed.
Yeah,
I know that.
Do better.
The high point of your, yeah, I'll do better.
I agree fully. You do not reverse slowly and incrementally out of a major blunder. You change quite dramatically. And this is a major blunder. This has become a major blunder. We have discussed before what an American administration that wishes to take action can do if it has the will. It certainly has the means, but if it has the will, what it can do is make it absolutely clear that they will not deal, the U.S. administration will not deal with Netanyahu. Somebody, you know, others have suggested Biden should go and address the Knesset and say precisely that. Regain the initiative here. And that would be a hit with the Israeli people, by the way, as Alon, you know, has reminded us. Netanyahu is deeply, deeply unpopular. Now, whether that produces a better interlocutor, whether Benny Gantz or Lapid or another figure who succeeded Netanyahu would be radically different? I don't know. But this is where the American leverage in terms of conditioning aid to Israel comes into it. Right now, America is complicit with wholesale slaughter of civilians on a scale that's just very hard to forgive. And as Rosa points out, is laying the seeds for decades more of radicalism, bitterness, ferment, recruitment to extremist groups to fight Israel. And therefore, the ultimate victim of this is Israel. So what frustrates me is that this policy is seen to be pro-Israeli. It is not. It is lethally harmful to Israel's long-term and, I believe, probably short-term security as well. It's not too late for Biden to change course. It's never too late, but it's got to be soon. Leaking things to news outlets about how Biden's really pissed off this time with Netanyahu does not cut it. Netanyahu doesn't give a damn what Biden thinks. Netanyahu is the world's expert in biting the hand that feeds him. And he will bite Biden's hand off if Biden lets him.
Yeah, I certainly concur. And Jeremy, you know, I presume you do, and of course, make any comments on what Ed just said that you'd like. But you've been in the U.S. government. I'm sure you talked to people who were your colleagues in the U.S. government. There is a strong view among literally thousands of people in the U.S. government that this policy is wrong and it needs to be reversed. But where first, and what should they do first? Because, you know, when Ed talks about there's still time, we're clearly not going to bring back the 30,000 Palestinians who are dead. That is going to be a stain that is going to be around for a long, long time. Those who suggest that people will get over it by election time or next year or whenever, they're just wrong, as you noted in your comment about famine. But should hundreds or thousands of Palestinians die the slow, agonizing death of starvation, it is going to have a multiplier effect on the hideousness of the policy. So, you know, you've advised President. What do you say? What do you tell him to do?
Well, I think he needs to put real consequences on the table. He hasn't done that yet with respect to the operation in Gaza. So what I find really striking is how different the approach is that they're taking in the West Bank. And obviously, I would love to see them be much more forward-leaning on the West Bank as well. But, you know, what have they done with respect to settler violence in the West Bank? They have put conditionality on weapons transfers. So no small arms can go to the settler groups in the West Bank. They have imposed travel bans. They have imposed financial sanctions now on the settlers who are involved, and that's having reverberations in the banking system, in the wider banking system within Israel. They haven't done anything like that with respect to Gaza. Far greater numbers of people dying. They're still transferring the weapons. I mean, there was a comment that Nancy Pelosi made at the Munich Security Conference about, well, nothing we've transferred since October 7 has been involved in this brutality or something to that effect. It's an absurd thing to say. It's demonstrably untrue, and it's puzzling to me that she would even say that. But I think they recognize that what they're doing on some level isn't working, but I think they've convinced themselves it's the best they can do because they've taken things off the table. And what it feels a bit like to me, so I was in government during the Obama administration when there was similarly widespread frustration with our Syria policy and a kind of frustration that we were trying to negotiate in Syria without putting any military leverage on the table. And, you know, whether that would have made things better or worse can be debated. But the thing was, a lot of people felt that way in the administration, and no one ever raised it in meetings because we knew what the president would say. You know, we knew that was a non-starter for the president. And so that's not one of the tools we pursued. And it feels like a similar dynamic within the U.S. administration right now to me. Everyone knows Biden will not put weapons conditionality with respect to Gaza on the table. It's the one thing that might make a difference. It's the one thing that he will not contemplate. And so everyone is scrambling, trying to use other tools that don't work, because the one tool that might is not an option. And so I think what he has to do, and it's like what you said in your article, which I thought was excellent, they have to put that on the table, because Netanyahu has shown phase after phase of this war, he will ignore the cautions they're giving him. He ignored what the president said 3 days after October 7 about following international humanitarian law. What he said about how wars are fought matters, that's been ignored. Blinken, strident or stark warnings when they moved the conflict to the south, that the conflict in the south must not look like the conflict in the north. It has looked just like the conflict in the north. And now they're making the same kind of warnings on Rafah. And the stakes are much higher on Rafah because there's nowhere else for people to escape to. But it's hard to expect a different outcome if they just keep trying the same thing that Netanyahu has ignored multiple times over the past 4 months. So they have to up the ante.
Absolutely right. And candidly, that means weapons conditionality. And if you don't have it, it's not going to work. And you know, as I noted in the article to which I made the first reference, I'll admit, I hold this administration in high regard, and I think they've done a lot of great things. I hold Joe Biden in high regard. I think he's done a lot of great things. But this series of errors will haunt them and could overshadow their accomplishments, particularly if we cross the dark divide to what we're talking about here.
The only thing I was just going to add to that is not just haunt them in a moral sense and a historical sense, but I think there's a very distinct possibility that, you know, if you have an extra couple hundred thousand voters in states such as Michigan who don't vote because they won't vote for Trump, but they're so upset at Biden that they stay home, that it could swing the election. I mean, I think it will haunt them in very practical ways.
Yeah, no question about that. So there's another set of issues I'd like to talk about here, and we will do that in one moment. This is where we take a break and we say to everybody who's listening in, who's not a member, be better if you were a member, because then you could listen to the rest of this podcast. Because we're about to enter the members only section. It's easy to become a member. You go to the dsrnetwork.com, you click on membership, and for $5 a month, voila, you're a member. You get 33% more podcasts from all the podcasts we do, the two daily podcasts that we're doing, each one of the daily deep dives. So it's more than 15 podcasts a week. It's a lot. So we encourage you. This is a good time to do it. It will help us enormously to continue this kind of in-depth expert perspective on news, which is what we do each and every week. But if you're not a member, for now we say bye-bye. If you are a member, we say stand by.